Cluster Conversations, a podcast by Africa Multiple.
Okay, my name is Carlos Köbel. I'm professor of psychology here at the University of Bayreuth, and I'm sitting here with Wanda Nyoya, who studied French at the Penn State University, is currently working in Nairobi, Kenya, has combined research with activism, and is currently working here in during her fellowship at the cluster. She's working, among other things, on a collected volume with Liz Cooper and Edmuta Alba on the education alibi. And maybe you could add a bit to those few points on your biography. I'm sure you will. You have much more to say about that, and then we can talk about your current research.
Okay, thank you for having me. I have become a public voice and an activist on matters education, because when I finished my studies and I returned home, I expected this glorious experience of teaching students. And then I discovered that the system has major issues to do with the philosophy of teaching, the philosophy of education, and then of course other political issues like the resources are located. And then I also, because Kenyans complain a lot about the education system, I wanted to explain to them why the education system is the way it is. And as I started talking in the public about education, I found that there were other social issues coming into the conversation which also needed to be dealt with. So all that is what has brought me here to Bayreuth to kind of reflect on those issues, and then sort of ask how can we help the public to understand so that we can politically make better decisions about our education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if I may sum up, you're not an educationalist by training, and you're not an anthropologist by training, but you have become, besides of your expertise in French, you have become an educationalist and anthropologist from inside, so to speak.
Yes, from experience. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
What leads us also to this project of writing a sort of autoethnography?
Yes.
Maybe you can comment a bit on that. I think you also you have already started, and mm-hmm. maybe you can add up on that.
Okay, what I noticed as I was confronting some of the issues I was seeing in the classroom and in Kenyan public life, what I noticed was that we talk a lot at the macro level. We talk about the policies, the implementation, the resources, but at the level of the policymakers and the politicians and the institutions, but all those things, when they come to the lived experience of teachers and students and parents in the classroom, it's a totally different story altogether. And there hasn't been much record about the lived experience of the education system. So that was where I connected with Edmuta and mm-hmm. Liz, because they're also looking at that, about what does school mean in the day-to-day life of Africans? What does school actually mean? So my project is to talk about my experience as an educator, but also as a product of that mm-hmm. education system, because I went through it believing that I was going to get something out of the system. And then when I finally reached the peak, I get back into the system and I discover it was like I was living in a different world altogether. What we were being told is different from the reality, the lived experience. So that's why I'm choosing to look at education from my own experience, not just as a professional, but as a person. Mm-hmm. Because I'm also going to talk about the anxieties that I face as a teacher, about my own social life and my health also, because they have been affected by my experience. So just to bring the totality of that experience into the story of Kenya's education, that's what my project is about.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned two pathways, so to speak, in writing this autoethnography. One from the perspective of you being a teacher at university, doing teaching at university, and the other as a product of the Kenyan educational system.
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit more about how these pathways intermingle, or what the differences are, where the points of convergence are? That would be one thing which I think would be quite interesting. And the other thing is, as a psychologist, I'm always interested in methods. And how would you describe your methodological, methodic approach in writing this autoethnography?
Okay, it's interesting you mentioned being a psychologist, because I'm trying to use quite a bit of psychology, although I'm not an expert. One of the things, as I started digging into the processes, the microprocesses of education, there's a huge psychological impact of education on our lives. From my experience, that it's a huge sense of guilt when you don't do what the system says should be done, but at the same time, it doesn't allow you to do those things. So you're left with this frustration and guilt, frustration at not being able to do what you're supposed to do, and guilt for not doing it. So I want to look at the internal, I'm going to be describing my internal processes of how I felt about certain things, but also go into why I felt that way. Looking at, for example, I'm a Protestant, and the Protestant religion has a lot about guilt and individual enterprise, and you know, all the Weberian, you know, discussion on Protestants. So there's because I come from a very strong Christian background, there's also that element. So I will look at that. I'm also going to look at discourse. You know, what do we do with words? So for example, one thing that happens within the education system is that we are policed through language. So we are not told not to think, but there are certain things we do with words that prevent people from thinking. So for example, if I ask an uncomfortable question as a student, the teacher will say, you're being rude, you're not polite, you're not respecting your elders. That's against African tradition. So there's a whole set of rhetorical practices that are embedded in the education system that eventually produce this person who becomes afraid, ashamed, and scared to think. And when they start asking questions, they don't know what to do when those questions are not answered. So there's that aspect, the psychological aspect, that I want to talk about. And then also the historical, institutional one. What are the institutional and political issues that are that are producing this kind of atmosphere in the school system? And then, of course, I'll talk a lot about violence. So the reason why I'm approaching it that way is because when I started asking the questions, why is the system like this? Then I started noticing I'm being silenced, but not with a stick, it's with words. I'm being made to feel guilty for asking questions. I'm being told what you're asking has no importance in our development as a country. I mean, there are so many rhetorical practices. And then the effect of that is guilt, shame, confusion, disempowerment. So that's all. So I want to bring all those things, because I think it's important for us to understand the micro processes of education. We've been talking about the big things, the policies, the institutions, the Kenyans will talk about this government report, the other one. but they don't talk about what does it actually feel like to be in the classroom, because that is where the real impact of our education system is. It's not just simply in the reports, it's in our lives. What does it do to us? And just to finish up, somebody, you know, in the course of my writing about this on social media, people have reached out to me and said, I still have nightmares about a particular episode in class. Someone told me, whenever he sees digits on a, and he's an accountant, but whenever he sees digits, which is all the time, he recalls the violence that was meted out on him when he was learning mathematics. So we have all these traumas that we are carrying, and we've not named them because the school is supposed to have given us a ticket to success, but we are hurting inside. So I'm going to combine both the psychological itinerary of my life with the historical one. So it's it will be interweaving both.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. As to the collected volume you're working with, listened at Mute, it's called Education Alibi. And of course, I have heard you talking about this title and why you use this title. But maybe you could say about this word alibi something. Mm. Why alibi? Why can education be an alibi? And what is your intention in addressing education as an alibi? What do you think are the advantages of such an addressing? What is it you want to get out of it? And what is it that you in fact get out of it doing it the way you do?
Mm-hmm. The problem with education has been that it's been difficult to pinpoint agendas. You know, for example, people will say, Africans will say, this education system is meant to disempower us and make us more vulnerable to exploitation. But that's not what the policies say. The policies have these grand themes about, oh, if we educate, we'll educate for development, we'll have a power, an empowered individual. But that's not what it's producing. So if you try to say, you people in the government are insincere, they're going to say, no, we did these policies with good faith. The fact that they're not, it's not producing what you want is something else, but we have done, the policies are there. That's what they'll tell you. So what we decided to do, instead of imputing a direct bad motivation on education as an institution, is to say we have some suspicions. Mm-hmm. We are suspicious. We have some questions. Mm-hmm. We wonder why education is turning out the way it is. But we don't have concrete evidence. But we feel, from the lived experience and the results we are seeing, we have a legitimate standing to ask, what is education really for? And then in the volume, all the contributors are presenting their evidence. Mm-hmm. They are saying, we are talking about education for all, but not all Africans are going to school. We are talking about education for empowerment, but people leave the system feeling extremely disempowered. We are talking about national unity, like in Kenya. That's what we talk about, but that's not the product. So we are just leaving it for the readers to say then, you know, what is education for? We've presented our case and we've presented our suspicions, but now we want the readers to be the jury and to say, is education guilty as charged or is the culprit somebody else? Mm-hmm. So that's why we are calling it an alibi.
Mm-hmm. So we are playing with this metaphor and using, as you did, words which are connotated with this metaphor, suspicion, evidence, presenting the case, the jury.
Yeah.
Is there guilt? Is there no guilt? Okay,
yeah.
I see. which I suppose shall end in a much more differentiated view on education, neither making it simplistic, guilty or not guilty, but yeah. With all the ambivalences it has.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, if I may return to the ethnography, mm-hmm. I suppose, and you also said that, at least implicitly, that such a first-person account as you are doing it is nothing which is widespread. Are there, nevertheless, are there perhaps other colleagues of you in Kenya or in Kenya who are trying to do such first-person accounts, either from an auto-ethnographical perspective or also from a, in a broad sense of the word, qualitative perspective, not only relying on one's own first-person experience, but collecting first-person experiences of others and trying to reconstruct them in a biographical way and interweaving them with historical things, just as you do. Are there other parallel approaches, projects you can communicate with?
You know, the problem of the academy, and this is one of the things I also found for Kenya, is that we are supposed to, you know, we are supposed to build up on what others have done. So the colonial education project, the way it was started by the colonial government, is that it depended on government commissioned reports. So the government commissioned reports are very detached and impersonal, and they are very policy driven. So that culture, that intellectual culture, has been imported into Kenyan education research. You find that a lot of, especially the education experts, they are driven by policy and the technical side of education. And even when they interview children and teachers, which, by the way, I was surprised is not very common, mm-hmm. Except through questionnaires asking, do you mm-hmm. like this? Do you like this? And then people say, yes,
so,
no. And then you,
so
then you tabulate the mm-hmm. data. But to actually go into people's lived experiences mm-hmm. and ask them to give an account of how they're experiencing the education system, those studies are rare. Mm-hmm. So part of, and so actually when I noticed this, I was saying that's why when we are trying to talk about policy, the policy makers and the academics can't hear us because they've been so used to this diet of technocratic, policy-driven education research. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to break that, and I think Liz and another colleague, Hilda Oburu, have started that kind of work of actually asking children, how do you process the mm. decisions you make? What are the things you saw and what led you to make the decision and how did you act upon it? Mm. Those studies are still not enough. We need more of them so that we can start to understand how does it feel like to be human in these systems. Mm-hmm. So part of why we came together and what we are hoping even after when I return home is to continue this conversation and talk about, ask scholars, how can we talk more about the actual lived experiences of people in the education system, not mm-hmm. just asking opinions and mm-hmm. tabulating them and yeah. doing a very quantitative kind of yeah. study, but how can we actually hear what people are saying and take their agency seriously? Mm-hmm. So those are the questions that, it's a methodological question mm-hmm. that we are now trying to push yeah. for in education thinking and education research.
Yeah, perfect. since you're also working as an activist or mm. also define yourself on the one hand as a researcher, but also as an activist, I would have two questions as to that, because I think that could be interesting. How would you see the relationship between you being a researcher on the one hand and being an activist on the other hand? Or is the whole question posed wrong from the start because these are not two roles which can be divided? How would you see that relationship? That would be one thing. And the other would be, how would you judge your, or how would you evaluate your impact on policy, on educational policy?
I think education is fundamentally a political project. It's political because it affects the decisions we make together, what we tell our young people about their past, so that it influences their future. So, and how we educate is decided by all of us together. That's what makes it political. And that's why I felt that besides having a conversation with people within the academy, which was very difficult anyway, I need to have a conversation with Kenyans, just to tell them, this is what is happening in the education system. These are the political choices we need to make as a country about what kind of education we want and what we want it for and why we want to educate in the first place. Those are political conversations. So in that sense, my scholarship and my political activism come together because I'm saying, with my research, I'm saying these are the issues, but with my activism, I'm saying we Kenyans have to make a decision. So they come together. That's how they come together. And what is my impact? I'm not sure. I think I'm going to be lazy here and say history will judge me. But I think the first key thing I want is for Kenyans to discuss education, because there's a sense in which they leave it to the experts. And the political discourse, that's what it tells them. Sometimes you will hear officials saying, what are you asking? Why are you asking these questions? We are experts. And they want it left there. And what I'm saying to Kenyans is that, no, if you don't understand, ask. Ask questions. If something doesn't work for you in the education system, it's your right to ask, what are you doing? You need to also understand, because this is a project that involves all of us. So in that sense, I think, I don't know whether Kenyans are hearing me. They say they do. Sometimes I get messages, or people will tell me, now I get what you're saying, or I'm listening keenly to what you're saying. Or some even say, today I did this because I heard you talking about this a few years ago, and I now get what you're saying, and I also stood up and said something. So to me, that's my role. I hope that my achievement is to change the conversation about the political decisions we make about education. That has to be all of us. It has to be Kenyans who decide. But for me, my key interest is to change the conversation, to say that we must all be involved in education and we must all care, because it's our children and it's the universe that is affected by how we teach our children. So we must all be involved.
Yeah. So if I may paraphrase it, and you correct me if it's wrong, your aim is not so much to change this law or that law, to change this concrete policy or that one, but to create consciousness in the Kenyan public, to inform Kenyan public, to give hints as to where discussions may be important and fruitful and things like that.
Yeah.
So enlightenment in a way.
Yes, because, and that I learned as I went along, it's not something I consciously mm-hmm. decided. Because what happened was when I started looking into the policies, I started realizing, whoa, how did this come up? What were we thinking? Who was doing it, you know? And then I realized there's no point of me talking about policy anymore. Mm-hmm. I started talking about policy, but I reached a point where I said, even the policy conversation is not getting us anywhere. The real issue is that Kenyans are detached and from the education conversation, and they need to get back into that conversation and drive it themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what would you think are the key issues in the Kenyan educational system at the moment? Or what can you tell us as persons who are not acquainted with the educational system in Kenya about the key topics, the really important things, issues at the moment, which you think should be discussed more in depth in the Kenyan public and which you are trying to contribute with your activism and with your research? And by the way, is your activism, could that also be framed as a sort of applied research? Would you say that that is a correct notion, or?
Yes, it is applied, because it's interesting that many of the questions I'm starting to ask, that I'm asking now, it's the Kenyan public that made me start asking them. It's my interactions with the public. When I say something and they don't understand, then I have to explain where this came from. And then the questions they ask me, or even sometimes the insults, they make me think, hey, you know, something there. So in a sense, it's not even so much applied, it's an interaction between my research and my activism. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of the questions I'm asking today have been informed by what Kenyans have asked me. Mm-hmm. So I find that to me it's a beautiful, it's a tapestry of what education should be. We should not be just people sitting in a building isolated from the rest of society. We should always be in conversation with society. So in that sense, my activism is part of my education. I mean, my research, it informs my research, mm-hmm. and then my research informs my activism. Mm-hmm. So it's a cycle. Mm-hmm. I would say the problems of Kenya, for me, the biggest problem is our philosophy of education. Education in Kenya, when it started under colonialism, was an access to economic advancement in an economy that was very constricted for Africans. Africans had lost their land, and so they were trying to enter the new economy imposed by colonialism, and the way they had to do it was through education. Unfortunately, that's still the problem, because we have a very constricted economy in terms of what it allows Kenyans to do. And so when Kenyans go into the education system, when they go into the schools, even their possibilities are also constricted. And so we come out of the education system, which is what I discovered painfully through experience, we come out very limited in terms of what we can do in society. And the education system trains us to expect those limitations. I'm just one of the people who said, I'm not listening to this. We have to break these barriers. So I would say philosophy is a big, big problem. We don't know what school is for and why we go to school. I think also, on the philosophical level, we are not sure what humanity, being human, means. Our education system is pegged, because it's pegged on development, meaning tangibles like infrastructure, money, and employment, it doesn't accommodate the bigger questions that we have to ask our society. It does not equip us to understand the place of Kenya in the world, the place of human beings, how do we relate to one another? Those questions are not dealt with by the system. I think those are the two big ones, because now when you start coming to resources, content of curriculum, all those are all tied to why are we educating. Mm-hmm. I think as long as we don't deal with those, the problem of why and the economy we are in, it will be very difficult to solve all the other issues that come. Like inequality is a big thing, but I think that's tied to the lack of clarity, philosophical clarity about why do we educate and what for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have also, I think, at least implicitly hinted at the role of colonial of the colonial system. Could you perhaps say something about decolonizing education in Kenya, since this is a major topic in many societies? What would you say is the case? Is important for the Kenyan case?
You know, Kenya, one of the biggest texts about decolonizing came from Kenya. So we've been talking about decolonizing for a long time, but it's not, which is what I'm going to say, it's not in our lived experience.
Mm-hmm. When it's I'm more on a discourse
it's
level.
It's more on a discourse level, okay. But when you actually come to the classrooms, when you go to the policy-making bodies, there's no decoloniality happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think for me, my shock was when we were getting this new education system, it was being justified with the racist policies of the 1920s, which was that Africans have small brains that stop developing at teenage, and so they cannot do literary conceptual education. They have to be trained to work with their hands. So we are still using that even today as an education policy. So one of the questions I'm going to be asking in my book is, why? Mm-hmm. We know that this is a racist idea. Mm-hmm. Why are we still repeating it in the 21st century? Mm-hmm. And one of the answers I have is because of the institutional culture. Mm-hmm. You know, you can talk big out there, but institutionally, the dynamics in the institution are still very colonial, and there's no language we have yet for pointing it out, because of the actors, we like the lecturers and the teachers, we find it very hard to raise these questions because it has to do with your pay. You know, if you ask too many questions, you could get in trouble with your supervisor, the school might fire you. So there are those practical dynamics that interact with these bigger decoloniality questions. So for me, I agree with the decolonial project. For me, I'm saying on the ground, it's a very different dynamic. Mm-hmm. And it's more difficult to ask the kinds of questions we ask at a conceptual level than we actually are aware of. It's very difficult to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
You've talked about limitations in the Kenyan educational system concerning for example, and that was a major topic you mentioned in respect to the philosophy of education. Now you know the Kenyan system, but you also know the US-American system.
Yes.
What about limitations of the US-American educational system you have faced when studying at Penn State?
Actually,
to bring in a comparative perspective, so to speak.
Actually, a lot of the issues that we face are American ones. For example, that idea of training Africans only for technical or vocational subjects, it came from the education that Booker T. Washington was being supported to promote in the late 1800s in the United States.
So saying the humanities is nothing which is really important,
yes.
But we need technicians,
yes.
Lawyers, physicians, and so
yeah.
on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The second issue which I found, I mean, in retrospect, I didn't know this when I was in Penn State, but now that mm-hmm. I'm thinking, is that there was a heavy concentration on the European Enlightenment curriculum. Mm-hmm. So that meant we did not really engage the social political issues of education within the United States. Of course, I'm sure the departments of education were doing it, but we didn't do it, at mm-hmm. least in my mm-hmm. education. So I think the issues are the same. And then when you look at the reforms that we are getting up to today, they are mainly produced from the United States with all their racial contradictions.
Yeah.
So for example, the new curriculum we got, one of the documents that was informing it was an experiment done in the Philadelphia schools. The school system is mainly for children from black communities, and the challenges they face are the same: poverty, lack of investment in the public education system. So I think it's an Anglo-American problem mm-hmm. when I look at it, even when I look at what the British teachers are saying, the people who are raising questions about the education system in the UK, even Australia, there seems to be a particularly Anglo-American character
mm-hmm.
to the issues that we are facing. So it might not, people from the French system might not quite resonate with the expression of those problems. It's mm-hmm. there's a way in which it's very Anglo-American. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I remember hearing you say at the conference on the education alibi that humanities, and you also mentioned it right now, that humanities do have a difficult standing in Kenya.
Mm.
Nevertheless, what would you say could be a positive role of humanities in Kenya in comparison to all these things also propagated by for example, the Anglo-American system to just focus on technicians, lawyers, physicians? What would be the valuable, fruitful, positive contribution of the humanities in an ideal world, so to speak?
Mm. The humanities is where we ask the simple question, what does it mean to be human in this environment we are in the world we are in? What does it mean to be a human being? So you can look at it through, how is that conversation had through music? How is it had through painting? How is it had through dance? How is it had through theology, even religion? All these areas is the human question. Who are we in the world we are in? That's what the humanities does, and that's why there's a war against the humanities. And even when you look, even right now, the controversy in the United States,
mm-hmm.
yeah, with the Florida governor fighting against African American education, it's still the same issue. You know, who are we? What does it mean to be human? Where are we coming from? Those are the questions that the humanities answers. And there's a very specific way in which the Anglo-American empire has always had a problem with the humanities. And that goes back to, in my view, I'm not sure, but my theory is that goes back to the days of the revolution, the fear of England that the ideas that were happening in continental Europe would come to England, so they have to block ideas, and that's what Edmund Burke was saying, we don't need ideas, we just need traditions. And then that kind of idea went to across the pond, and it was also brought to the continent, to the British colonies like ours, where The goal actually for Kenya and Zimbabwe and South Africa was to make them white settler colonies. So whatever philosophies the British were living with, they brought them to Kenya. And that's the sense in which Kenya has to confront the colonial problem in a slightly unique way compared to other mm-hmm. former colonies of Britain, mm-hmm. because the intention was for the settlers to stay. So the system we have was for the settlers. It wasn't for us. It was for the settlers. So the humanities has a very tortured history in the empire. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what we are also grappling with mm-hmm. as Kenyans. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you perceive allies in Kenya for strengthening the role of humanities? Can you build alliances with colleagues, or is it very, very difficult and every person works for his own and doesn't connect to others in order to improve the situation?
I would say, like, the Africa Cluster Center, it has been unique in that way. When Moi University, which is one of the participating universities, when they invited me, I was so thrilled. I was so thrilled because I was saying, oh, finally, I can go and talk about the things that matter to me. And we are having conversations that matter.
So this is what we wanted to hear.
Yes. That we can have conversations that matter. And in fact, I think there was one conference where we were at where there was yet another scholar from Egypt, on Dr. Damaris Pasitao, who said, I'm so happy to be here because finally we can talk about the things that matter to us. We've been talking to foreigners, but we are not having the conversations mm-hmm. here. So the multiple cluster is part of that building a mm-hmm. community to finally get the humanities back in the seat and to start saying how can we bring these conversations back to the education institutions and also mm-hmm. the public. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as to your fellowship here in Bayreuth, what are the things which are still in your agenda for the time you are here? What is it what you want to, what is it what you still want to do?
So I'm just writing the manuscript, mm-hmm. yeah, because being here affords me the time to do it. That's another micro level issue in Kenya, that we have such a huge teaching load, we have mm. so many things we are dealing with, so we are not able to take some time to sit mm-hmm. and reflect and write. So that's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm just also building up my research, reading a lot more of the things I wanted to read but didn't have time or access to resources. So that's what I'm doing while I'm here. I hope I'll be able to have something decent by the time I return.
But the manuscript is something other than the autoethnography.
That's the one. That's the one.
That's the manuscript.
That's the manuscript. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we are hoping that when we go back, we are hoping to call humanities scholars together and mm-hmm. ask the questions we are asking and say, how can the humanities contribute to education research? We can't always be listening to the policy researchers. Yeah. We also need to talk about the human beings who are in education and how can we use research to do that? Mm-hmm. So that's something we want to do when I go back home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as we're talking about the cluster, what is it what you perceive as helpful, valuable, fruitful, and what do you see limitations, problems, things that could be done better maybe?
The conversations. I was craving the conversations. So the cluster center has done that, both here in Bayreuth and in at home, mm-hmm. at the university, at Moi University. So I think it's, the important thing is not to underestimate the power of conversations. The thing with conversation is that there's no immediate output. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sometimes people can get impatient and say, oh, you're just staying here, you're just meeting, but can you give us something tangible? But there's a lot of power in people mm-hmm. meeting and talking and refining their ideas.
Certainly, yes.
Yes, mm. So for me, that's the greatest value. It's also been interesting to be in Germany. The country that we are told about, that's not what I've seen. There's a character to Germany that I think needs to be talked about a little more in terms of its presence in the world with all the problems, yeah? Because I think there's a similarity. I know maybe Germans wouldn't believe this, but sometimes I see a similarity in the way they experience public life in institutions and the way we Kenyans struggle with the same institutions. So there's a solidarity that we can have, but we need to meet more, know each other more, invite each other more to our home. So I'll invite you to Kenya, come to, and meet my people. Yeah, so I think it's the conversations are mm-hmm. really, really important. Mm-hmm. And that has been the greatest value mm-hmm. that I have. Mm-hmm. And the space mm-hmm. to think, mm-hmm. the space, oh my, Kenyan life is so difficult. So the space to think, mm-hmm. yeah. I think what I would just say is that keep adding more and more conversations, more opportunities to meet and mm-hmm. be with people. I think that's the power of education. That's what mm-hmm. education is. It's people meeting. Mm-hmm. And talking and thinking through things together and sharing their experiences. So that has been the best experience. Mm-hmm. I just also want to say I'm also grateful to Moi University mm-hmm. and Professor Simatei. I hope he'll hear this. Because it was through him and the Moi University that I am here. Mm-hmm. And not simply because of knowing about the fellowship, but just that they started they gave us a platform to have the conversations. Mm-hmm. So, and this happened at a time I was about to give up. Mm-hmm. Really, I was about to give up, and then they said, "Can you come and talk about?" I can't remember what they said. A topic of your choice. And I was like, "Oh wow, this happens in Kenya. It still happens." So. I think what I would say is don't underestimate your impact. Yeah, the impact is there. It might not be tangible, but it's there. Yeah, I can feel it. Yes.
Okay, I think there could be no better words to end the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much too.